not often on the CJOB sports show, and this is not a criticism of Krishna Mel, it's just kind of the reality of it, do we talk mixed martial arts. UFC 300 on the weekend, T-Mobile Arena in Vegas. It was absolutely electric, and it was about, I don't know, like 8 straight hours of fights culminating in a really awesome knockout in the first round for Alex Pereira over Jamahal Hill, I think is how you say it. But we bring in CJOB's resident UFC expert, Tyson Rewicki. I can say that because you made me money this weekend after picking a couple of fighters. And man, what a great celebration of the sport and the premier event in the Ultimate Fighting Championships history on the weekend.
Oh, absolutely. And I think, too, I might mention some names that people are going to have no idea who I'm talking about, but
that's all right.
Like, just top to bottom, it was the greatest card of all time. To start off the card, we have two former champions, and like the very first fight of the card, two former champions fighting off against each other. Like, it just doesn't get any better than that. And man, like they delivered fight after fight after fight. There was a few couple stinkers kind of sprinkled in there, but you know, for a UFC event, you can kind of expect that. And man, like I'm sure a lot of people saw some of the highlights, and it, not very often does a card that has that much hype behind it deliver, but it delivered and then some, which is insane to even say.
Well, and how long had you been looking forward to this one specifically? Because I mean, like UFC 299 was what, 3 weeks prior? Like, it's not like we've had a big layoff or anything like that, but obviously everyone's had this circled on their calendar for a long time.
Well, and even UFC 299 was a huge card too in and of itself. And you add that before 300, it kind of adds that build up to it. And I've been, you know, since about UFC 290, which was in July area. And that's when Dana White really started hyping it up a little bit. And I think some people were disappointed originally when it didn't end up being Alex Bahia and Jamahal Hill being the main event, but because he kind of teased that it was going to be like a Conor return or even a guy like Brock Lesnar coming back, which would have been crazy. But it ends up with the light heavyweight championship. And you know, people kind of hated on the idea a little bit at the beginning, but we've seen an absolute ascendum into superstardom for Alex Bahia. To come in, be the only guy who's knocked out Israel Adesanya in kickboxing before that, and then comes in, knocks him out in his own weight class. Unfortunately, they rematch in the UFC. Adesanya got a little bit of his comeback, but he's moved up a division, won that belt. He won 2 belts after 5 fights in the UFC. Like, that's insane.
Yeah, that's crazy.
And so he's got the 2 belts, goes in, beats the 205 belt holder, then beats the guy who had the belt before but had to vacate due to injury. And so he's already cleaning out this division already. And after he won on Saturday night, he said he wants the 265 heavyweight champ, the interim champ, Tom Aspinall, next month in Brazil, his hometown.
And what does he weigh right now?
He weighed in on the weigh-in day, which was Friday, 205 pounds. On Saturday night, he rehydrated to 237.
And he's still going to go 30 up from there in a month.
And that's what he wants
to
do.
Or he says he wants to.
We'll see if that actually happens. But man, like, there's never been a triple champ in the UFC. A double champ's crazy, but a triple champ to go up, and especially 185 to 205, that's 20 pounds. Usually it's just a 10-pound difference in between. Like, holy. It's something we would never see before and we'll never see again, probably.
Do you think he, could get there weight-wise, and B, would he have a good chance if he got into that fight?
He could definitely do it. I think he could probably bulk up a little bit to 245. He has fought at heavyweight and kickboxing before, and he has won championships in kickboxing, and he's got, his left hook is a kiss of death. It just is. It really is. You can look up on YouTube just long highlights of just his left hook, and he sets it up perfectly. It's the ultimate one punch knockout. Like, no one else has that in the UFC.
And we saw it on Saturday.
Exactly. And Jamahal Hill's taken huge shots from guys at 205, and he just slept them, and he glanced. It wasn't even a full punch. It just glanced off his temple, and he sent them into a shadow
orbit.
Like, it's it's honestly,
he was in Reno, Nevada.
He's the most terrifying guy in the UFC by far.
And that our other producer, Max Reed, had said, I wasn't able to watch this fight, but that was the first like big power punch he had thrown in the entire fight. Is that true?
Yeah, he was stalking him down. He himself had even said, I kind of wanted to win by a decision. And show levels to this. And then Jamal Hill kind of took things a little bit too far in the press conference. And he's like, you know what? I'm going to shut him up.
Yeah.
But it was awesome, too, because right before he lands that knockout punch, he gets groin shotted. Clear as day.
Yeah.
Ref comes in the stepping to kind of give him his break.
Yeah.
And he puts his hand out, doesn't break eye contact with Jamal Hill, puts his hand out. Herb Dean, the ref, steps away. First punch after. Like, it's the guy's too cold. Like, that's the only way to describe him. He's just a cold dude. And he doesn't care. He'll beat anyone.
What was your favorite fight of the night if it wasn't that one?
Oh, it was not. It was the BMF title. And I can't say what BMF stands for, but I think people can put it together. It's bad. You know what? And man, we saw the two baddest dudes in the UFC ever. Max Holloway and Justin Gaethje. Max Holloway has done more in his career than people will ever do. And he's only 31 years old, or 32. I believe he's 32 years old. He's already wiped through the 145 division. He's beaten greats like Jose Aldo. He's gotten the belt. He has lost to Alexander Volkanovski in a couple of their fights, but he's regarded as the greatest 145 of all time. And some people think that Holloway won the first two fights.
Right.
So he has his credentials, but he moved up a weight class to fight Justin Gaethje for no reason other than I wanted to prove to people that I'm that dude.
Right.
That I'm him. Well, like you said, after
was that his first fight at that weight?
He had fought one other time before against Dustin Poirier.
Okay.
And that was short notice, 3 weeks.
I think I remember that.
And he just popped because that was when I believe that was Khabib have to pull out. And so Holloway came in last second to kind of just fill a card. And so that happens. Holloway, he struggled in the beginning. He couldn't handle Poirier's power. And then he kind of did better as the fight went on, but ended up losing a unanimous decision. But he comes up against Gaethje. And Gaethje just beat Poirier, too. So it's not like he's fighting a can or anything.
Yeah.
He's fighting one of the best 155ers. And all respect to Gaethje, too, because he had everything to lose. He had the next title shot lined up. But him being a bad dude, too, he was like, you know what? This guy wants to come up and challenge me. Then
let's go.
I'll challenge him and put on arguably the greatest fight in UFC history.
Really?
Without a doubt, the best moment in UFC history. There might be some more action-filled fights, but you had all the implications. You had all the build-up to this fight, too. This fight was the most anticipated on the card, even though it wasn't the main event. And for Max Holloway to go there, he's winning 4-1. He doesn't have to do what he does, but he goes in the center of the octagon, and he throws his finger down right in the middle and says to Gaethje, let's go.
Raider.
You and me, whoever stays standing these last 2 seconds wins. And they do that. And Max Holloway,
so cool.
With 1 second left. This is movie stuff. Like, honestly, you couldn't write this. 1 second left. He sleeps Justin Gaethje. Justin Gaethje has been knocked out before, but they are TKO finishes.
Right.
So it was like it was multiple punches and an accumulation of damage.
Yeah.
Holloway, one shot, boom.
Bang.
Put him to sleep. No one's ever done that. And for a guy moving up a weight class to do that, it's absolutely absurd. And now Holloway, he could fight. He said they would never do this, but he said he wants to fight for the 145 title as the co-main event and then fight for the 155 title in the main event.
In the same night?
Yeah.
That would be... That's insane.
And that's why he's got the BMF belt.
Right.
Because he's just that bad of a dude. He's like, it's unbelievable.
That is crazy stuff. Okay, so it seems like every centennial card for the UFC is a hit. Obviously, they get bigger and bigger. Like 300 and like the group and Dana White just have to be so happy with how this all turned out. Because you can set it up, obviously. You can hype it up, which he's been doing for almost a year. But at the end of the day, you need your fighters to go out there and put on a show. And basically everyone from top to bottom of the card did that.
Oh, absolutely. And no one missed weight. No one had to pull out due to an injury
or
anything.
None of those controversies.
Like even at UFC 200, they were supposed to have Jon Jones headlining against Daniel Cormier in their rematch. And Conor McGregor as the co-main. And both of those fights didn't happen.
Right.
Jon Jones tested positive for steroids. That got pulled. And I can't quite remember exactly what the reason for the Conor fight getting pulled, but you know, like those are the two biggest stars in the UFC and that just ruins the card.
Yeah.
And so like for them to do all these, I'm sure that there was backup fighters in case someone wasn't able to go, but you very rarely see a card hold up just normally. Like if it's a normal pay-per-view or a normal fight night, there's always at least one cancellation. And the fact that they were able to do that and then 90% of the fights delivered, and then your main card absolutely delivered.
Right.
Like, it's, you're setting up now for the 301, 302, 303, and 303's Connor coming back.
Right. Tyson Rewicki, thank you for beefing up my bank account this weekend. You sold this parlay of four fighters or five fighters on whatever it was on me on like Wednesday. I'm very happy I listened to you, my friend, and now the good people that listen to 680 CGOB Sports Show get to do the same thing. Tyson will be out with his picks for 301 for you for sure.
We
might have to put him behind a paywall though, because you're automatic.
Yeah, you know, if people want it, send it on the text line and you know,
follow him on Twitter.
Maybe we can work something out.
Thanks for this, buddy.
Yeah, no problem.
One of my favorite guests joining me back on the 680 CJOB Sports Show. It's been a while since we spoke to Jeremy Kaler, golf journalist, caddy master at the Manitoba Open. But hey, it's Masters Monday, I guess you could say now. The dust has settled. Scottie Scheffler's got a new baby on the way and a second green jacket to wear to the hospital, I guess, as well, as he finishes up with a four-stroke victory, 11 under par, and wins the 88th running of the Masters tournament. Jeremy, lots to get into here, obviously. Tons of storylines coming out of Augusta National this week, but let's start with the champion. I thought on the front nine on Sunday, Scottie Scheffler didn't really look like he had his best in terms of ball striking specifically, and the next thing you know, he ends up winning by four over Ludvig Åberg, and that kind of just shows how far ahead he is over a very talented group of golfers on the PGA Tour and the LIV Tour as well right now.
Well, not only is he the best golfer in terms of just being able to hit the ball far and in play and in control the ball, control his misses, he also right now is probably the best mentally prepared golfer on any tour. He is calm. He doesn't get too frustrated. He was very chill. He had a different demeanor than I've seen before, and I think that's his new caddy, Ted Scott, who has also helped him and just reinforced everything that he already believed. Scheffler has no lack of self-confidence. He knows who he is. He knows what he's doing. And he wasn't really too concerned about messing up. And if you are mentally free, it's amazing what you can do. I know that when I golf, if I'm mentally free, which has happened to maybe once in the past 10 years, I've played a remarkable round. But for him, you know, with all the distractions, as you said, the baby on the way and everything else and the media hype coming in as one of the favorites, the mental fortitude that he had was just amazing. I don't think we've seen this probably since Tiger in his prime.
Yeah, and well, you know what? That was something I was going to ask you later on. I'll do that now. And just for context, for folks that may not be following the golf world as closely, Scottie Scheffler and his wife Meredith expecting their first child. I think she's probably due about a week or so from now. But he had said all along Masters Week that, hey, if now is the time, he's going to get the call. A cell phone's not allowed in the grounds at Augusta National, but I believe Ted Scott, you know, had an exemption, the caddy, and had one in his golf bag. He could have been on 14 yesterday and got that call from Meredith, and he said he was ready to go, but luckily she held on, and he gets to win the Masters, a $3.6 million payday, and then they can enjoy the birth of their first child when it does come. So, yeah, and I was going to ask you this, basically fill in the blank, Scottie Scheffler's run is the best we've seen since blank, and you say Tiger Woods probably in the mid to late 2000s there. I mean, this is simply incredible with three wins in his last, what, six starts now, including a T2 that he could have easily put into a playoff if he didn't miss a 5-foot putt a couple weeks ago.
Well, and that's the thing, is people don't realize that how good he's actually playing. It's the PGA Tour now is more of a what have you done for me lately. Well, he's done a lot lately.
Yeah.
And the fact that he also had the T2. It's not like he's been playing bad golf. He's been playing really consistent and hitting the shots when he has to. And that was pretty cool what he did on Amen Corner, is where basically everybody fell apart and he's the only one that stayed composed and he went and cleaned house.
Yeah, I don't know if he was leaderboard watching exactly, but Ludvig Åberg and the group before him put one into the water. Colin Morikawa really put one into the water just a shot before Scottie was approaching the 11th green there as well. Tough approach shot, but I think he kind of had the benefit of watching all those guys go before him, and he kind of seen it all laid out in front of him and just knew he had to avoid the mistake there that, yeah, everybody basically made before him.
Well, the interesting thing is, so Amen Corner, which is, you know, 9, 10, 11, he played that 2-under, so he went birdie, birdie, bogey. But the 5-hole stretch from 7 to 11, he went bogey, birdie, 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 bogey, which for most players, that's really, really good. So the fact he did that with under the circumstances, and everybody else was making double bogeys or pars, and he ended up 1-under cumulative for that stretch. That's basically what separated him, and then it was just a cakewalk in from there. He also hit some really clutch shots, though. 14 and 16 was something else.
Yeah, he looked absolutely dialed in coming into the second nine for sure after three straight birds around the turn. Started the day at minus 70, had the one-stroke lead on Morikawa, who kind of went backwards around that same time, really, right around the turn and going into Amen Corner. And the only other person to get down to minus 7 was Ludvig Åberg. So I do want to talk to you about the runner-up. This is his first major start. He's 24 years old. He looks like he's built in a factory. Super composed. Looked like he was having a great time out there, and obviously played some awesome golf all 4 days.
Okay, so I don't know if anybody caught it, but I mean, they mentioned it in the post-run interview too, but he, I think it was on 8 or 9, he was eating a little protein bar or some energy bar or something like that. And he was giving high fives and, you know, just totally engaging with the crowd. And his protein bar slipped out, and instead of getting upset or whatever and keep walking, he just looked at the guy and went like, "Really?" And then big smile on his face and took off. That attitude, that is huge. He was just excited to be there. Now, Åberg is really cool because last year he was like 3,000th in the world.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's professionally ranked, right? He used to be the number one amateur in the world. But for him to have that attitude, I mean, to finish 3-under for the day, 69. He only had one round. I think it was the first round he was over par, but the rest he played under par. And except for the one mistake on 11 where he got a little greedy, he held his composure, and he was just happy to be there, which was really cool.
Yeah,
I first major too, correct?
Yeah, first major start. He would have been the first player to win his first major start since Keegan Bradley in 2011. I think there's only three guys that have ever done it in like 100 years. Super impressive. And if you don't know who Ludvig Åberg, I should say his name right, but I see it Åberg and I read it like that. It's Ludvig Åberg, Swedish player. He will be a household name in the game of golf, for years to come, certainly. Who else impressed you out of the top 10? Who were the movers? Obviously we saw Colin go backwards, and I thought he put together a really good week, but I mean, Tommy Fleetwood rocketing up into third place was really impressive to me. Who else kind of stood out for you there?
Max Homa. If you listen to some of the interviews and some of his interactions with the media, really good attitude. He was a kid in the candy store the first two rounds because he was playing with Tiger,
yeah,
which was basically his idol growing up. And he played well. He was 5-6 under for the first two rounds combined with the pressure of Tiger, and all eyes were on Tiger. So that was really cool. He unfortunately finished two over for the final two rounds, but that's still tied for third, which is a really, really good result. He was, all the interviews, everything he said, he's saying the right things. He's done a lot of work on his mental game. He hasn't really shied away from that. And you could tell he had really good demeanor and was kind of aware of his situation, which sometimes when you're playing with Tiger Woods or you're playing in a big event, that can escape you, right?
So, yeah.
I was really impressed how he was just steady for the whole tournament.
Well, let's talk Tiger. I mean, I was so impressed on Friday. Goes from the late start Thursday, doesn't get the round done, plays 22 holes of golf Friday, and I think any golf fan understands what Tiger's going through physically. Got about 2.5-3 hours of sleep, they said on the broadcast, comes out there, finishes his first round, absolutely battles on one of the hardest days I've seen at Augusta National in my 20-plus years of watching the Masters, makes the cut, 24th straight time, all-time record, beats Freddie Couples, and I think there's another golfer who also held that record at 23 with Tiger for the moment. And, you know, things kind of got sideways on him on the weekend, but I thought it was so impressive for him, you know, at his age and everything he's been through, to go out and battle on one of Augusta's worst days and get it done and make the weekend.
Well, I don't think I've ever seen any kind of, you're right, I've never seen anything like that condition-wise. Like, there was multiple players who said the round should have been stopped. There was, Friday, there was a wind warning for the Augusta area. Like, that's... When the National Weather Service puts out a wind warning and you're playing on greens that are like 14 on the stimp, it can make for some pretty interesting stuff. The way he battled with the holes that he played and then on such little rest was impressive. Unfortunately, he basically wore himself out.
Yeah.
He just couldn't recover. That wasn't so much a mental thing as I think his body was just exhausted. And it was unfortunate. I was hoping he would go 68-68 on the weekend and challenge. I would have loved to see his name in the leaderboard and seen how some of the newer guys would handle that, because none of them have ever dealt with Tiger in a major in the final group. So
yeah.
Or near the leaderboard. It would have been really cool to see, but unfortunately, what we hoped for, it wasn't meant to be. But still, the fact that he went 73-72, that's unbelievable considering he has an engineered ankle.
Yeah, no, it was, and if you didn't watch on Friday, I think it was hard to, you know, yeah, he made the cut, you know, he was well inside the number. I think he was T21 after two rounds, so didn't even have to sweat it out. And to watch some of the shots and, you know, his overall demeanor on Friday when things were getting absolutely gross out there for a lot of players, it was super impressive. What does the future hold for Tiger in your mind? Like, he said coming into this year that he wants to play once a month. We haven't seen that. He played all four rounds and played well at times this weekend, which I guess is a step in the right direction, but the last two times we saw him out at the Open Championship and again at Riviera earlier in the year, he didn't finish the tournament. So where are you at with Tiger, you know, finishing up this year? Obviously he's going to push to play all four majors and, you know, make some more cuts, and I know Tiger Woods wants to win the darn thing too. So what do you think the future holds for him?
I don't know. I wish I could say, you know, looking the, you know, the crystal ball so to speak, and say, yeah, he's going to do this and that. Honestly, I think it depends a lot on how his ankle holds up. If he's able to walk, he has enough experience and he's played enough courses that he can scrape his way around and be competitive. I think he can be competitive in all the events and all for all four rounds and probably challenge for the British. The thing with Tiger is, yeah, he doesn't have a lot of reps. A couple tournaments he's going to play in, he had to leave one because he got the flu. And then another one, he didn't feel ready. So he's at one a month. I think he can work his way up. He can practice the shots. He can do it at his own pace, which is probably good. The thing that I think he's most concerned about is terrain, walking on uneven terrain.
Yeah.
A lot of hills. Now, Augusta, people don't realize how challenging Augusta is. Augusta is, if anybody's played Minnewasta, it's like Minnewasta or Pine Ridge on steroids. You're going up and down, and it's not exactly even lies.
No.
So there's a physical toll, too. And the British Open is generally played on slightly flatter courses. He can play some more different type of shot, so he can keep the ball low. He doesn't just have to hit as far as he can and then hope to have a wedge in. He can, you know, hit those short irons or hit those mid irons lower, flighted. So that's more where the experience comes into play. And we're hoping that at the British he can, at least be top 15, top 20. And that's just basically he's doing it in based on his previous reps. So
right.
But I don't see him doing much more than that, and playing a lot of the non-signature events. I just can't see it happening.
No, he certainly has Troon, Pinehurst, the U.S. Open site, and Valhalla circled on the calendar. And I think anything else, not only for him, but for golf fans, would be a bonus for sure, because he's going to try and game the four majors, obviously, and take it from there. Well, let's talk PGA. It's a month away tomorrow, some 600 miles up the road in Louisville, Kentucky. Valhalla will host the PGA Championship, and Jeremy Kaylor, the winner, will be blank.
Oh, good grief. Zalatoris.
Will Zalatoris. All right. Yep. He had a good weekend, hey? He kind of put it together, and the putting was impressive, because that's, I think, the one thing everyone has to wait and see with his game. But obviously, you know, on a really, really bad weekend for the golfers on the greens at Augusta, he looked pretty good.
Well, the thing is, he's redone his swing. He had a back injury.
Mm-hmm.
He was off for quite a while, revamped his swing. And if you revamp your swing, you also have to change your short game. So he made all these changes, and now they are starting to come together. Yeah, he's a fantastic short game. He's a really good ball striker. He has good imagination. And three under on the weekend, put it together. He didn't do anything too crazy.
Stuck so in the top 20, I think, right?
Pardon me?
Stuck in the top 20, I think, with that weekend performance, right?
And so he only had, I think he had one bogey on Sunday. So his game is shaping up. He can work the ball both ways. He likes to get creative, and he doesn't mind having to play some tough shots around the green. He used to have a bit of a sketchy putting stroke.
Yeah.
That's now been fixed. He's gotten much better at that. And therefore, you start to see the results combined with a much improved physical body.
Yeah, super exciting player. He was on the 2017 Walker Cup team that featured Scottie Scheffler, I think Colin Morikawa. There were a couple other, big names on the tour that were on that team as well. And Zalatoris has kind of taken a backseat to those guys, who both have two majors now. But, super exciting player for sure. I got to let you go soon. We're running out of time, but I do have to ask you about the Canadians. Corey Connors, by far and away, the top Canuck down at Augusta National. What did you think of everyone's game? Adam Hadwin made the weekend. Nick Taylor just kind of played himself out of it on Friday afternoon when conditions got tough, and Mike Weir put up a pretty good fight too for an old guy.
Connor's ball striking is amazing. He is one that I would say, if there's a Canadian to win at Augusta, it would be Connor's in the future.
Yeah,
just his ball striking is amazing. The only other person is if they can make it in would be Taylor Pendrick, because he can absolutely annihilate a golf ball, and he can take a bunch of the bunkers out of play. But I was really impressed with Weir. As part of the old guys, he did, and I say the old guys jokingly, but he did really well. He was one shot off from making the cut. He was scrappy, and you could tell that he was a little disappointed that he wasn't able to get it done. Hadwin made the cut, which was good, but everybody was derailed by either a bad Friday or a bad Saturday.
Yeah. Everybody but Scottie Scheffler.
Correct.
Yeah. Jeremy, man, thanks a lot. I could talk golf for the full 2.5 hours of the CJOB Sports Show with you. So to squeeze it all in a couple segments is truly a treat. It's good to talk to you again, man.
I appreciate it. Thank you. And anytime.
Joined now by one of my colleagues in calling Manitoba Junior Hockey League games, the voice of the Steinbach Pistons, Dave Anthony, joins me now all the way up from the lobby of the Kiki Lac Hotel in the Paw. One of two big game sixes on tap tonight in the Manitoba Junior Hockey League. And Dave, this will be playing, I guess, at some point during probably the first intermission or second period. So good luck to the Pistons tonight, first of all. And the backs are against the wall for the regular season champions in the Manitoba Junior Hockey League tonight.
Yeah, it's the first time since round one of last year against Winkler, actually, Steinbach's up for elimination. And talking to the coaches and a couple of the guys, the mindset is the same as when you're trying to put a team away. You cannot go out of what makes you successful. You cannot be chasing the game. You just need to kind of let it develop and see where it goes. It's going to be a hostile environment, obviously, on the road. But, Skyler, the Pistons have been here before. They know what it takes to win. They know what they have to do within themselves to find a victory tonight. And it's just about one period at a time, one shift at a time, as cliche as that sounds.
Well, it's been an awesome series to watch unfold. You and I were on the call in game one when the Blizzard scored with, I think it was probably about 3 minutes left in regulation to take a win there in game one. And then it was Sam Zagari with, I think, 38 seconds left on Saturday night. And you had an excellent call as they would clinch that 3-2 series lead with that late regulation win. So for a team that in the Steinbach Pistons that lost only two games in their temporary home of LaBrokerie all season, it's been pretty impressive to watch the Blizzard, you know, kind of be patient at times, ride their good goaltending and calm defense, and take the most of their opportunities, and now take two wins out of that building in the last week and a half, and now have the series lead.
Yeah, I mean, anytime you can score in the final minute on the road in regulation and win games, it says you're doing a lot of the things right, but it's a lot of the way the Blizzard play. They're very well structured. They're okay playing a one-goal game either way. They believe they can score, but they can also defend a lead when they have a one- or two-goal lead. So they're very comfortable in those close games. Like I said, they're very structured. Sebastian Hamming has really led the way on the back end. But they've got depth up front that I don't think gets enough recognition. Marlon Edwards has had a really good playoffs. That top line of Quincy Supri and Riley C, Sam Zagari, they've been really good. But then you add Keenan McNeil back in, and all of a sudden, they're a lot deeper than they were in round one against the Dauphin Kings. So they're playing structured hockey. They're playing Blizzard hockey. And you're right, when Steinbach sags, the Blizzard seem to find another gear. And just when you think that it's going to kind of coast, or we're going to have a couple minutes to kind of see where the game develops, the Blizzard kick it into another gear. And that's what Steinbach needs to be ready for tonight. You cannot take your foot off the gas. They need to be playing fast in your face hockey from puck drop to final buzzer, and we'll see if they're up for it.
I think this would be the longest road trip in the Manitoba Junior Hockey League. Maybe it's a little bit longer for the Winkler Flyers to go all the way up to the Paw, but regardless, it's been a back and forth series and both teams have won games on the road. So for those who haven't been up to the Paw, been to the Roy H. Johnston Arena, just kind of describe what the Pistons, Paul Dick, and the players are preparing for tonight, especially with the home team on the verge of going to the Turnbull Cup Finals.
Well, it's not as intimidating as the Gordon Laughlin has, and for any Manitoba Junior Hockey League fan from history knows, that arena used to be very, very intimidating. But the Roy H. Johnston is quickly catching up. It is a tough building to play in. There's bleachers on both sides, so the noise really just kind of filters right on top of the players on the bench and on the ice. The fans are dedicated. There's signs, there's horns. There's a lot of people that are willing this team to get to a finals again for the first time since Brady Keeper got them there a few years ago. This is an organization that is looking to take that next step and to be consistent winners. They don't want this to be a flash in the pan. Eric LaBrosse has got a really good program. They've got some great volunteers up here as well, and they're looking to use this as a stepping stone to be consistently in the semifinals or finals going forward in the MJHL. And the fans are ready for it, but Steinbach, they're veterans, they're professionals, and they know that they're going to try and rain on a parade tonight and have a happy bus ride and make some folks a little miserable coming back to southeastern Manitoba on Wednesday.
Well, and when we did the game on two Fridays ago now, it was for game one, I was you know, very pleasantly surprised to see how many people came down to support the Blizzard in that game. I'm sure you've got a few fans of your own up there with you today.
We did for games three and four, maybe a little less up here today. It's a bit of a trek for a Monday, but
right.
I know a lot of fans are going to be listening and watching, and I know fans are going to be cheering on a couple of birthday boys and Brandon Funk and head coach Paul Dick, who's celebrating a birthday today. So looking forward to maybe giving them a birthday present.
I'm sure they want to give themselves one for sure. Who's the X factor for the Pistons tonight? If they're going to even up this series and have the chance to go back to LaBrokerie with the chance to advance to their second straight Turnbull Cup final.
You know, it's easy to say a guy like Cole Plowman, who I thought was sensational in game five, but I'm going to go with the captain, Leo Chambers. Steinbach needs to score goals. Like, that's something that's really been tough in this series. The Blizzard make it tough to score goals. So a guy like Leo Chambers, he put his team on his back in game number four. He's going to need to do it again in game number six. And he's a distributor as well as a scorer. So he's going to have to find a way to do it in all different ways, whether it's power play, penalty kill, or 5-on-5. So for me, it's the captain, Leo Chambers, tonight.
And for the OCN Blizzard?
Well, it's hard not to look past Thomas Anderson.
I mean,
he's going to have to be on top of his game. Steinbach's going to be throwing everything. It's going to be kitchen sink hockey tonight. So he's going to need to be dialed in. His rebound control hasn't been great at all times. He has let a few things kind of loose around his crease, but he fights to see pucks from distance like few goaltenders I've ever seen. He's really good at battling, and he seems so calm in the crease. And no matter how many saves he makes, he's just always ready for the next one. So it's a cop-out to say the goaltender, but it's going to be up to Thomas Anderson to weather some storms tonight for Steinbeck.
Well, that is one of two potential series clinching games going on right now as you're hearing this on the 680 CJOB Sports Show. It's also been a pretty back and forth series between the Verdun Oil Capitals and the Winkler Flyers. Verdun had the 2-1 series lead, and then Winkler gets a couple of double overtime victories, including a Dalton Andrew game-winning goal on the weekend, and all of a sudden they're up 3-2 with the chance to clinch tonight at Tundra Oil and Gas Place. Another home team in this case trying to keep their season alive instead of advancing to the next round, but should be another dandy tonight in Verdun.
Absolutely, and again, you talk about the Winkler Flyers. They are desperate to get to the finals. If they don't, it would be a failure of a season. Dalton Andrew had a quiet first round and a pretty quiet second round right up until his two double overtime wins in back-to-back games. But you need your big-time players to make big-time plays, and the Flyers have gotten that. The Verdun Oil Capitals, they've been in this situation before. They weren't expected to maybe make the finals last year, but they did. They beat Portage in Portage in Game 7 when they were set to host the national championship. So Verdun knows when their backs are against the wall, they can find a way to fight through. Tyson Ramsey's going to have his guys dialed in, and that's been a very fast series. Talking to Kevin Pauls, he says it's faster and more physical than what Steinbeck and the Blizzard have been doing. So it's going to be if the Oil Capitals can keep playing fast, keep out of the trenches where Winkler's going to try and drag the game, then the Oil Caps will have a chance. But we'll see if Verdun's bully hockey can get them to a Turnbull Cup final like they so desperately hope it does.
Well, and it's been it's been a playoff style series because these are two teams coming in outside of your Steinbeck Pistons that had the most goals for in the Manitoba Junior Hockey League this year in the Verdun Oil Caps and the Winkler Flyers, two of the top three. But really, it's been more Winkler, it looks, that's been kind of struggling to score at times. Obviously, they got a little bit of an offensive outburst there on Thursday with five goals, including that double overtime game winner. But other than that, two goals, one goal, two goals, zero in game one as they were shut out 4-0. So what's kind of been the secret sauce for Tyson Ramsey and the Verdun Oil Capitals at kind of limiting a pretty lethal offense in Winkler there?
It all comes down to speed, whether it's speed of the defense moving out of the zone or speed of the puck getting off of a stick and not letting Winkler come in and bully them around and force some turnovers. So whether it's the players moving themselves or just quick puck movement, it comes down to speed. And a few of the goals that the Flyers have scored, especially in Tundra Oil and Gas Place, have been when defensemen of Verdun have made mistakes. It's really hard to play perfect hockey, but you have to play near perfect hockey this time of year if you're going to win. So if you're the Verdun Oil Capitals, you just got to move pucks quick. And if you're Winkler, just stick with what you've been doing. Just try and get in there, force some turnovers, and believe eventually you're going to force something and then take advantage of it.
Well, it's going to be really exciting to watch this unfold tonight, Dave. The cynic in me wants to see the rivalry come full circle, full boil. Steinbeck Pistons, Winkler Flyers, Turnbull Cup final. And I mean, no disrespect to the OCN Blizzard or the Verdun Oil Capitals, who've had remarkable seasons, and really got to tip my hat to the Blizzard and the turnaround they have had this year. It's been remarkable, as you said. But I do want to see your Pistons stave off elimination tonight, send it to a Game 7 a bit later this week. And I'd love to see the Winkler Flyers get there, because it would be 10 out of 10 junior hockey if those two teams were to meet up with the championship on the line.
I don't think anybody outside of maybe the Blizzard and the Flyers would not love a Game 7, one in Winkler, one in Steinbeck, to see who goes. But you got to get through Game 6, and by the time this is played, Skyler, who knows, my phone may be thrown across the Roy H. Johnson at this point. We'll have to wait and see.
They got netting all the way around the rink there, don't they?
Yeah, the players are safe.
Okay. Well, all the best, Dave. I won't be able to listen to your call, but I know you will have a good one, my friend. One of the best in the business. Good luck to your Pistons tonight, and we'll watch it unfold here as we go along in the CJOB Sports Show.
Sounds good. Till our paths cross again, my friend.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his six-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his two-year-old at the rink.
All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone.
Like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.